Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. This is the first Old Mole of November. I'm Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer today. We're on the air the day before the election, so you'd expect our program to focus on some of what's at stake tomorrow and in the days to come. We face tremendous uncertainty, not only about election results, but about their implications. What is the relationship between voting every 2 or 4 years, and actually having some say in the country's direction? Is democracy something more than voting? Will there be an effort by the incumbent to steal the election? If the challenger clearly wins, will the movement so painstakingly built over these last few months pack up its tents, go home, and expect the winner to resolve the problems we face? As far back as I can remember, well before the Rainbow Coalition and Jesse Jackson's campaigns, and all the way through the movement to elect Barack Obama, the presidential election marked the unfortunate endpoint rather than a continuation of popular mobilization, of movement energy. Old Mole Bill Resnick leads off the program with two short interviews. Bill has been doing a weekly series on the possibility of a Trump attempt to retain the presidency in the face of an adverse vote, what some people are calling a coup, and on lessons from other countries on successful resistances to coup attempts. Today, he talks with Stephen Zunis, emphasizing nonviolence, not necessarily as a principle, but as a crucial tactic in these circumstances. Then Bill talks with Alejandra Moreno of the local Defend Democracy Coalition. There will be a major demonstration the day after the election, both to defend the election's integrity and as a pledge, no matter the results, to stay active around all the issues we face. With Moreno, Bill continues the discussion of nonviolence and the measures the coalition has taken to make the demonstration family-friendly. After those two interviews, I'll be joined by Luisa Herrera for a conversation about police reform. Our takeoff point will be the police accountability measure on the Portland ballot. We'll talk about the real social change necessary to get true police accountability, about alternative visions of public safety, and about how limited reforms can play a role in larger social transformation. As I mentioned, we're at the beginning of November, and that means not only elections, but looming winter. Claudia Rankine, a distinguished Black poet, author of Citizen and Don't Let Me Be Lonely, two books in my library, reads her poem, Weather. But by weather, she's talking about a whole lot more than rain and sunshine, heat and cold. Bring your umbrella, just as if you were going to a Portland protest, and listen closely. And now, Bill Resnick with Stephen Zunis.
Stephen Zunis, welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be with you, Bill.
Ibn Zuna studies and writes on the international system and its politics. He specializes in the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, and he also writes on strategic nonviolent action. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and he's also an activist in those strategic nonviolent action movements. So, Stephen Zunis, you studied when coups and generally all illegal seizures of government power have been stopped. In fact, you've written, it's become a relatively short book. It's titled Civil Resistance Against Coups, A Comparative and Historical Perspective. Stephen, tell us, what's worked to force coup leaders to step down and to flee into exile if they can? And then we can discuss how do those mass movements, how do they force the usurpers to flee?
Well, basically, the whole idea is that governments are only as powerful as the people's willingness to obey them, to recognize their authority. And when we have seen coup d'etats reversed by mass nonviolent direct action, when we've seen incumbent regimes try to hold on to power by stealing elections, people have often risen up and said, no, I don't care what you say or what the electoral bureau says or what the corrupt courts say, we are not going to recognize this illegitimate authority. I've had a number of articles. One is a monograph I wrote actually a few years ago. It's available on the website of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, in which I look at a dozen cases of popular uprisings against coup d'etats. But I had one just came out last week that looked at what may be more apropos examples of four cases, the Philippines in 1986, Serbia in 2000, Ukraine in 2004, and Gambia in 2016, when incumbent regimes tried to hold on to power by claiming they won elections they had clearly lost, and the people rose up. And what I found in common were six things. One was a meticulous election monitoring and related efforts, which enabled the opposition to make a convincing case that there was indeed fraud and there had not been a full and accurate count of the vote. Secondly, mobilization of large numbers of supporters within days as it became apparent that there were efforts underway to steal the election, building on networks of oppositionists which had been active for years. Thirdly, was large-scale non-cooperation challenging the legitimacy of the incumbent government, including popular contestation of public space, strikes, civil disobedience, and establishing alternative centers of power. A fourth was strict nonviolent discipline by the opposition, even in the face of violent repression. That next was the support of both the centrist political grouping whose candidate had been robbed of victory, as well as grassroots elements of civil society to their left. And finally, loyalty shifts among regime allies, including non-cooperation, defections, and desertions by government officials and security forces. And I think really had the potential for all of this. And the Democratic Party also already has thousands of lawyers and monitors. The question is, will we be able to mobilize? Biden isn't a very exciting candidate, but neither were the opposition candidates in these other cases. But people realized that they were fighting not for this particular candidate, but for democracy itself. And that enabled such a broad cross-section of the population, ranging from people on the far left to members of the business community, to unite in engaging in massive non-cooperation. And this is what we need to really be prepared for here.
This is your Old Mill Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Bill Resnick here talking to Stephen Zunis, who teaches and writes and demonstrates in San Francisco. He's written the book, Civil Resistance Against Coups, Comparative and Historical Perspective. The Defend Democracy movement is so important to us because Portland has been deeply impacted by groups of right-wing provocateurs who deliberately incite violence, try often successfully to give the police the excuse to attack, beat, arrest the protesters, break up demonstrations. Stephen, how can this whole process be interrupted?
I think it's a really important thing that those who are protesting for democracy to try to defend the election and make sure every vote is counted, to maintain nonviolent discipline. In all these cases, you know, none of the leading opposition figures were pacifists. They weren't saying, let's be nonviolent because, you know, we believe for religious or moral reasons that everybody has to be nonviolent. They just realized that on utilitarian terms, on practical terms, that any use of violence, even simply vandalism or throwing rocks and bottles, would be used by the authorities, by those in power, those who wanted to subvert democracy, to suppress them. And, of course, when attacked by various right-wing goons or other supporters of the regime, the media would depict it as clashes between the two extremes rather than that of people who were nonviolently protesting a stolen election and those who wanted to stall an autocratic regime or keep an autocratic regime in power. Yeah, nonviolent discipline is very important. And it's scary here because the biggest fear of repression, I believe, is not from the U.S. Army. I think they'll try to be apolitical and keep out of it. I think most democratic-run cities would not unleash police on people simply protesting to have the election results counted. We have tens of millions of Trump supporters with guns. But let's remember that during the civil rights struggle, you had hundreds of people killed by Knight Riders, by the Ku Klux Klan, by others, who similarly did not want democracy, did not want to give everybody the right to vote. But the nonviolent discipline of the civil rights movement in the face of this repression brought enormous sympathy and support from across the country. And the key is to get the people who might be on the middle, those who may not necessarily like Trump but don't want to engage in a nonviolent revolution or an unarmed insurrection. Keeping the nonviolent discipline is really critical to get these people on our sides. And another critical variable is numbers. The bigger the numbers who are engaged in this mass non-cooperation, civil disobedience, and the like, the stronger the movement. And people are much more likely to go out on the streets if you don't have to worry about various provocateurs provoking conflicts of various kinds where people could get hurt. You know, people are going to get hurt either way, but it'll be far, far worse and far less effective if our side also engaged in violence.
Unfortunately, I think right now a lot of these right-wing provocateurs have read Mein Kampf and Hitler's rise to power through creating chaos. And they infiltrate. Great size makes a difference because the infiltrators can get isolated and disabled nonviolently by groups of people. But how have those movements dealt with deliberate efforts to create chaos by people who look like the demonstrators?
Well, one thing is to engage in training, nonviolence training beforehand that can prepare people for just such scenarios. There's a group called ChooseDemocracy.us, which has been doing online training to thousands of people across the country. There's also a manual called HoldingTheLineGuide.com, which also gives some practical advice and even agendas for meetings and workshops that people can organize themselves. There's also a large effort called Protect the Results, which is part of the largest effort of this kind, which includes various liberal and progressive environmental groups, civil liberties groups, you know, like Move On, Sierra Club, others, who have also been organizing. And what's exciting about this for me, actually, is that not only for those of us who come out of the nonviolent democratic left that have had a lot of experience and resistance in nonviolent direct action, but we're getting surprisingly mainstream people, liberals and others, who maybe signed a petition or done a few, you know, legal things like that, that are now ready to go out onto the streets because our democracy is at stake here. And a lot of people recognize it. So we're having unprecedented numbers of people who are training and preparing to engage in nonviolent direct action for the first time. And I find that really exciting, frankly. Hopefully, Biden will win by a big enough margin that it will be impossible for Trump to use state legislatures and the federal courts to steal victory. But, you know, if there was only like a 20% chance of your house burning down, you'd want to know where the fire extinguishers are and how to use them. So I would encourage listeners to check out those resources. Again, they're choosedemocracy.us. HoldTheLineGuide.com, and Protect the Result.
Steve Zunis, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you, Bill and Stephen Zunis. Bill follows up on some of those same themes next with Alejandra Moreno.
Alejandra Moreno, welcome to KABU.
Thank you for having me.
Alejandra Moreno is the founder of Portland Speak Up Now, a campaign to protect the integrity of this coming election. She's also the coordinator of Communications Committee of the Defend Democracy Coalition, which is new, but already has 40 member organizations. The coalition has organized a rally and march. It will be next Wednesday, the day after the election. Like in many cities in this country, it will demonstrate commitment to a fair election, as in one of the slogans, let people vote, count all the ballots. The rally starts at 3 p.m. in the big field adjacent to Revolution Hall, the once Washington High School building on 12th and Stark, and will happen regardless of the outcome, whether, as expected by all observers, Trump goes through with his threat to steal the election, or if Biden wins, will still rally and march, because this country and the planet face immense challenges. We'll be discussing that later in the interview. First, Alejandra Moreno, tell us about the rally and march and why it's so important to come and be heard.
Well, Bill, thank you for having me representing the Defend Democracy Coalition. In terms of the rally that we're holding, the Defend Democracy Coalition is coming together around the need to protect the integrity of our elections and to count every vote of the people that participate in those elections. With the amount of people in the current situation in the U.S. are voting by mail, and all those votes need to be counted, and that will take time. We're shifting away from the idea of a November 3rd election day to more of an election season. The reality is we might not have a full view of the results on November 3rd on that night, and that is why our November 4th event stands regardless of what politicians say on television, regardless what the results that are called out by the media. We are standing up and getting together and demonstrating to essentially protect, make sure that all the votes are counted, even those that are coming by mail that might take some more time to count. And to understand that, like you said, beyond the elections of 2020, there are a myriad of challenges that we're facing in this country. And regardless of the outcome, we still need to push for those.
The march and rally is described as nonviolent and family friendly. I think it's real important to get the largest number of people out, which includes people with baby carriages and families. It's after work, starts at 3 p.m. Tell us about why you're so specifically insisting that it will be nonviolent, and what is the coalition doing to make sure that any violence will be deterred?
Throughout history, the most successful struggles in the face of authoritarian overreach, like the one we're facing now in the U.S., have been nonviolent struggles. So it's more than just the absence of violence, it's the strategy behind it and the shifting of the power balance through nonviolent direct action. And this might take many forms. On November 4th, it'll take the form of a mass demonstration where we rally the people in our city and in our state to join millions around the country in saying, we're here to stand up for this, and we will not be ignored, we will not be dismissed. So the nonviolent aspect is much larger than this demonstration on November 4th, but we do want to highlight that this is a family-friendly event. We want everyone to join because this is a matter that affects all of us, regardless of our race, our gender, our religion, our immigration status. All these issues are affecting every single one of us, people all over the country. So we're demonstrating to stand up for that and to make sure we're all protected. We want to make sure that at this rally and at this march, people are comfortable coming out and demonstrating their voice. We have an entire group, an entire committee dedicated to community safety and making sure all the actions that we put together are safe for the community to participate. If we're going to put ourselves out into the street, we want to make sure that we do that safely and we're not putting the community at risk. So that's something that's very high on our priorities list to make sure that we have all of the measures in place that people feel safe demonstrating and to make sure that we de-escalate any sort of violence we might encounter. We're preparing our people for that and we're making sure we have people trained around our events to make sure that we can de-escalate any violent situation.
My sense is if Trump does attempt to steal the election, it will be a long process. Could last all the way into January, and the struggles to count the vote will surely wind up in courts and local struggles and in state legislatures. It's all quite possible. Not quite as intense in Portland as it will be in Pennsylvania and Florida and Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin. So the march on the 4th, it's probably going to be the first of many, many actions. Some of them will be more disruptive than others. That is, one of the ways of stopping coups is to make sure that the autocrat or dictator that want to take over, to make sure that they can't just stabilize the situation and continue to milk it for their own gains. Often the coup fails because it's impossible to maintain business as usual, and the people are united in pushing out the dictator and trying to initiate some much more democratic government. So some of the actions in the future will be quite disruptive, if nonviolent.
This march is disruptive in the sense of we will demonstrate, and it's not something that happens every day. So it's disruptive in that sense, but future actions will be disruptive in different senses. The Defend Democracy Coalition has a pledge, which is how people can join in to this effort. And it's based on the Choose Democracy Pledge, which is national. And it has 4 steps. We're committing to voting. We're committing to refusing to accept the result of the election until all votes are counted. And we're committing to take to the streets nonviolently if a coup is attempted. And like you said, we're willing to shut down business as usual to protect the integrity of the democratic process. With our lack of cooperation, we get to move the needle in how things work. So if we choose to remove our cooperation from certain aspects of our society, we are affecting that business as usual, and we are disrupting that process. And essentially, that's our intent. It's all nonviolence. It's all our effort to make sure the voice of the people is heard. In a system that continues to disenfranchise different populations, we're aiming to make sure that it isn't just another one of the many times before where we have seen, oh, no, yeah, we'll get to that. We'll address that. The time is now. This coalition believes that the future that we want, we're starting it now. It's not later. If an administration is willing to work with us, we will do this or that. We're going to mobilize and make our point heard. We can't ignore the context in which we live and pretend that this election is happening in a vacuum. This election is happening and is contested in the way that it is because there has been very intentional efforts to disenfranchise voters all across the country, disenfranchise specifically Black voters and young voters, because that's the biggest threat to the established system right now. So we want to make sure that people feel empowered, that people know their voice and their power and how big of an effect we can have. And they show up on November 4th and throughout to join the coalition in fighting for the future we want to build.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Please note that this variety, it's in the variety of struggles for that better possible world, struggles often from below. I'm Bill Resnick talking to Alejandra Moreno, who is the coordinator of the Communications Committee of the Defend Democracy Coalition, over 40 organizations, more to come. We've been discussing the coalition's family-friendly rally in March. Again, it's next Wednesday at 3, starting at 12th and Stark. Alejandra, even if Biden wins, we're going to have to mightily push him and his administration to meet the country's and world's multiple challenges. The coalition is not a one-time rally in March instrument. It sees itself as assisting in and coordinating what will very, very likely be a long period of struggle to not just defend electoral democracy, it's to advance democracy and deal with the multiple challenges that this country and the world faces, really existential challenges.
Yeah, the Defend Democracy Coalition came together because we're witnessing presidents and political allies that are very intent on suppressing the vote and undermining our current electoral process. And all this with the intention of illegally maintaining power and subverting the will of the people. So we're coming together to stand up for electoral justice. while we understand that in this context, electoral justice is racial justice, is a fair economy, is climate justice, is all of these things, we have to come together around the elections right now so we can move forward and continue to work on these issues, because the system right now does not work for every person in this country, and we need it to, because all of our lives can't matter until Black lives matter, until LGBTQ lives matter, until immigrant lives matter. So we have to take this stand, and right now we focus in the elections, but we have a vision that is way more long-term than that, because we want this to be a space we want to create. So that is what we're calling for. Join us, defenddemocracycoalition.com. Take action with us and join us on November 4th at Revolution Hall at 3 p.m.
That's www.defenddemocracycoalition.com.
On the website, you'll find information on the pledge, information on our November 4th action, and also all of our social media links as well.
Thanks so much for talking to us today, Alejandra. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
We've heard Bill Resnick with both Stephen Zunis and Alejandra Moreno, two interviews on the politically charged and extremely important events coming up this week. Now we turn to what's been a long-term struggle that will also reach a significant stage this week, the struggle to change racist and politically reactionary policing practices. We'll do that through an episode of our continuing series, Another World is Possible. That was our theme music for Another World is Possible from The Coup. We have the guillotine. We'll soon hear a bit more from Boots Riley of The Coup. In past episodes of Another World is Possible, we've examined an effort to create a utopian community through an ironic short story by Louisa May Alcott. We've looked at dystopian fiction through a two-part series on Fred Feil's novel, Goodman 2020, and taken up the question of what it is that enables people to recognize that there are alternatives to the society that exists. It's not at every time in history or in every society that people can sense the possibility that things can be different in fundamental ways. We're in one of those exceptional times right now. More than outlining a good future or warning against a bad one, Another World is Possible has also taken up difficult questions of transition. How do we get to significantly different and better social and economic arrangements? Back in July, Luisa Herrera joined us on Another World is Possible to talk specifically about police unions as obstacles to social change. She had recently initiated and participated in a panel discussion about police unions for Jobs with Justice for an audience of union members. You can find our July discussion on police unions by going to the Old Mole Archives at kboo.fm. Today, our theme is police reform more broadly. What follows are extracts from a lengthier conversation. Luisa, welcome back to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me.
In our July program, you made some points that haven't widely been part of the ongoing discussion of police reform. I'm going to attempt to summarize them just for the sake of efficiency and then give you a chance to amplify or clarify what you think I've left out. You pointed out that historically, when police unions have been formed, police killings increase, and that's especially true of police killings of Black people. You understood that. You suggested we understand that in terms of the lessening accountability. Police are held less accountable when they have a union formed to defend them. You pointed out that many of the relevant provisions governing policing are not in the union contracts, but rather in the manuals of practice that are actually management, that is, local government documents. So you made the very strong point and the very interesting point that killings and brutality are not simply attributable to the police, but to local government efforts to control and suppress populations. As an experienced public sector bargainer, I'm going on with summarizing some of our conversation from that earlier July episode of Another World is Possible. As an experienced public sector bargainer, you pointed out that bargaining should be public and that legislation at the state level can change, could reduce the areas in which people are entitled, in which unions are entitled to bargain, that some of those areas could be cut back in the case of police unions. Our discussion recognized the possibility that right-wing forces could use this effort to cut back on the wide range of bargaining for police unions to attack all public sector unions. But resisting that attack, and this is where our discussion ended up, resisting that attack and making clear what we won't stand for in police practice is an opportunity to revitalize the labor movement by clarifying what we do or what we should stand for. Now, Louisa, that's been a lot to take in. Would you like to amplify or clarify?
So I would say it's not just an opportunity, it's also an obligation that we have, particularly to our Black union brothers and sisters, and also the way that some elements of the labor movement has treated non-white union employees historically. I would say that it's not just an opportunity, it's also an obligation. I mean, I think if there's ever a good time, it would certainly be now in terms of taking a stand on police accountability and trying to legislate out of existence all the special rights that they've been able to get for themselves, including stuff like special pensions, which police do have.
And use that as an opportunity to focus on what our labor movement is or should be, what we should be standing for.
Yeah, exactly.
The kind of criteria that we would bring to bear on police unions. Our takeoff point today is the police accountability measure that's on the Portland ballot. We're airing the day before the election, so we don't know whether that's passed or not. But let me ask you, Louisa, under the best possible scenarios, if this measure is passed, if it survives court challenges, and if the state legislature follows up and does what the measure calls on it to do, what would this police accountability measure accomplish? And then we'll go on after that and talk about the dangers it might bring and what it wouldn't accomplish. But first of all, what would it do?
It would give the jurisdiction to community oversight committees to be able to discipline police officers. They could investigate, they could compel testimony, that type of thing. So it would put into the hands of community members the right to that particular right, which is essentially to discipline and terminate.
You've suggested in our conversations that one of the dangers in passing a police accountability measure is that it supports the notion that bad practices by the police are the exception.
Right. Yeah. And it ignores what the social role of police actually are. So those of us who know our history understand that police were a product of slave patrols. And so what the function of police is to protect private capital. It's certainly having a civilian oversight committee really focuses on, the kind of bad apples without as you and I state, getting to all of the other problems that are caused by too many police.
In another episode of Another World is Possible, I want to explore at much greater depth how it is that the kind of social economic arrangements we have, how neoliberal capitalism requires increasing repression and requires a militarized police, that they go together, and also that that militarization, that repression is racialized in multiple ways. You've raised these issues now. How do you understand them?
There is a really particularly brilliant and accessible essay by a man named Boots Riley, who's a rapper from the coup. He summarizes it really well, and he says that, you know, you under capitalism, you can't have full employment, right? That gives workers too much power. And so capitalism necessitates unemployment. And so those of us who have taken, you know, college level or even high school level economics classes, you know, unemployment is seen as some natural thing. You know, it's like inflation. We don't really understand if it exists. Under capitalism, you kind of have to have a group of unemployed workers so that bosses can keep wages low by threatening workers with the idea that they're going to be replaced. And so the bigger that that group of people is, what we label competition, flexibility, whatever, the lower that wages are. You know, as far as most employers are concerned, the point is to keep wages as low as they possibly can. Alternatively, if there was full employment, workers could say, I want $75, you know, an hour or I'm out, and the boss really couldn't replace them. The point is that capitalism needs an army of unemployed workers in order to exist.
And how is that racialized?
Well, I mean, I could take myself for an example. I was an undocumented immigrant until I was just about 21 years old. And so I had to work under the table. Because of my immigration status, it necessitated me working under the table. And so something that should be really straightforward, like the ability to drive or work, became politicized because of essentially a racist and a bureaucratic immigration system. You know, there's lots of instances where people are forced to find alternative forms of work because of a pervasively racist criminal justice system that disproportionately punishes Black people and brown people in a way that it doesn't with whites.
Where do we go from here? What kind of a vision of what public safety could be like do we have to offer?
You know, when you talk to advocates of police reform and particularly police abolition, what they implore people to consider is, you know, redirecting funds that would otherwise go to police into public services, right? And so we've heard that those of us who are interested in this type of thing, we hear that over and over again. One thing that might be equally successful is just kind of, as you say, presenting a vision in terms of what community policing actually looks like. And so, you know, one of my favorite examples is Cuba. And Cuba, following the revolution, had this idea of this kind of democratic superstructure where people participated directly in resolving their own problems, right? And that was really the point, particularly with the Lo Comité de Defensa de Revolución, the CDRs. You know, they focus on a lot of things. They're neighborhood-based organizations, and they are concerned with all kinds of local issues, neighborhood aesthetics, health and social issues, and crime control. And they do a wide berth of things. They have regular meetings, block meetings. You know, they help elders, you know, do fixes around their houses, that type of thing. But most importantly, everybody has a relationship with one another. And so they can address neighborhood crime control in a way that's far more effective than having an outside person come in and just kind of respond to the issue the way that police do in the United States.
The example I like best is the Seattle General Strike, when workers themselves ran the city and there was no crime. Unarmed vets returning from the war patrolled the city. The police didn't come out of their barracks. And for all the days of the strike, all the days that workers stayed away from their jobs, there simply was no crime at all in the city. Those suggest some of the kind of criteria that I think that you just raised as well. And we can reiterate the criteria, but let's turn and talk about the obstacles first to change. Always we see as conditions worsen, there's a tendency to double down on what seemed to be before as past solutions, solutions in quotes. We've, of course, already talked about police unions as obstacles. Social transitions are difficult. So let me ask you, this is a question that you've posed to me at times, when people come up to you and they say, well, what are we supposed to do when there's a home invasion? What's your thinking about how to respond to that kind of question?
It's a difficult question. Crimes are different in differently constituted societies. Ultimately, I can speak for Cuba. You know, I've heard Cuban authorities say, well, you know, we need something like police, even if we don't call it that, even if they function very, very differently in Cuba than they would in another country. Ultimately, you need to be able to respond to white terrorism. But I think I would urge us to consider what comfort are we getting from having, or what's the subtext of the question? And the subtext of the question is, ultimately, I'm afraid, right? And I want to be able to lay my comfort in an authority that will respond to something like a home invasion. And I think part of why crime is much lower in Cuba than it is in other countries in Latin America is, again, kind of coming back to this idea of direct participation in resolving their problems. This idea that it's not just about redistributing wealth, but this idea that we're going to release everybody's creativity and participation in society. And I think people find comfort in police because self-determination, these types of things like these community organizations, this neighborhood organizations, where you're meeting and you're solving your own problems, that's scary. That type of freedom comes with the type of guarantee, a lack of guarantee that the police provide. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't move toward it. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't aspire to kind of move in that direction as a society.
Social transitions are difficult and people resist because there are consequences. There are costs. I think of kind of my family background long, long ago, freeing of the serfs. There were serfs, many, many in Russia, who did not want to be freed as they understood what was happening. Or in U.S. labor history, some of the main events that we celebrate, major sit-down strikes in the 30s that formed the CIO, when you look closely at them, it's a minority of workers who are participating. Others are simply, well, it's fearful, what you've just been saying, Luisa. It's difficult to imagine a new situation of forming a union where you're taking responsibility for control over your workplace or partial control over your workplace. It's only after contracts are won in that kind of a situation that people jump on board and join the union. Transitions are difficult. To summarize quickly where we've come to, one, the kinds of problems that we face are a function of the kind of society overall that we have, that simply reforming the police is going to require much larger social change to get an alternative, to get a real alternative vision of what public safety should be. Two, that there will be difficulties in that transition, and they'll require organizing well ahead of time. When we talk about just transition, for instance, around environmental issues, as well as kind of prefiguring, we'll have to come up with solutions we can partly bring into this society that persuade people that alternatives really are possible. That's where we've got to so far in the conversation. I want to mention another facet, which is we've talked about police and how they function vis-a-vis racial minorities in this society and how they defend property rights. What about police versus those who want to bring about change, whether minority or not? What about police versus the left? Something to say there?
Yeah, I mean, police are essentially an arm of the state. We could see very clearly as a result of national rebellions, especially as they took place in Portland.
Well, what I'm thinking of is in my time in Portland, these many decades, there have been repeated discoveries that the police were engaged in illegal surveillance, illegal infiltration of left groups, of groups interested in social change, who were not committing any crimes. There have been red squads, you know, gathering information, monitoring activity oriented towards social change in an effort to repress it. When they've been discovered, the police have vowed each time, this has been a repeated pattern, that, oh, we're disbanding that group and we're destroying the files. And then a few years down the road, we discover that they've been doing the same thing under a different name. They've been discovered and they make the same vows. And then a few years down the road again, because I've been in Portland for a while, we find out that's simply part of their function. That's part of what they do in society. These red squads, keeping track of, trying to repress efforts at social change. And so the question is, what role do police play in the society? And Luisa, you've answered that earlier. It's to defend the status quo, basically, to protect property and to repress efforts at change and to repress racial minorities necessary for the continued functioning of the economic system. So that takes us back to this police accountability measure. You raised earlier that it's been criticized as reformist, which means not having the potential to bring about real change. Can you say more about what that criticism is?
Well, like I said, a lot of it comes from that graphic produced by Critical Resistance. I don't know your feelings about whether, you know, how much of a distinction there is between a reform and a revolutionary charge. At the end of the day, if this measure were to pass, at the very least, it would be a gesture, right? It would be a sign that the majority of people in Portland believe that there needs to be stronger accountability.
To answer your question you posed to me, I don't accept the distinction between reformist reforms or supposedly revolutionary reforms. Any reform can be co-opted. Some reforms have more potential than others, but there's no reform that's per se revolutionary. The distinction I would make is it depends on how you work with the reform. And I think that's what you're getting at when you talk about how this accountability measure, if it's passed, opens up possibilities for us to go further. But in order to do that, we have to let people know, people have to understand the limits. And that's what we've been trying to do with precisely this broadcast. The police accountability measure, if it's passed the day after you're hearing this broadcast, is a starting point for us. We can go a lot further and we would need to. Luisa, the last word goes to you.
Well, right. And I would add that in order for real change to occur, it would require the participation of other labor unions, because the rights of cop unions are so tied up with the rights of other union members that we would need a unified force to be able to say that cops don't have the right to murder unarmed Black people. And this is the movement that's going to change that. But like I said, because all of these rights are so intimately related, it would require that type of coalition work at the state level in order to get real reforms, I would argue.
And so the struggle continues. This is Norm Diamond. Been joined wonderfully by or with Luisa Herrera. And this has been Another World Is Possible. Before turning to the poetry of Claudia Rankine, I want to alert you to another upcoming event. This one for the Pacific Northwest Intercampus Organizing Coalition. On Friday, November 13th, Peacock is holding a virtual organizing summit from 4 to 7 p.m. focused on organizing to confront academic disaster capitalism in the age of pandemic. The goal is to build power across campuses in the Pacific Northwest to radically re-envision higher education. How would you like our colleges and universities to be? How about equitable, sustainable, affordable, accessible for all? Breakout groups at this virtual event will lay the groundwork for intercampus organizing campaigns. For more information and registration, go to peacock.info. That's capital PICOC.info. I began this program with a comment on the weather. Poets and authors use weather as a metaphor for even larger concerns. Oscar Wilde put it well. Whenever people talk to me about the weather, I always feel quite certain that they mean something else. And you already know the quote attributed to Mark Twain. Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. That Gilded Age radical probably meant more than a superficial quip about what's happening outdoors. But in modern times, he could well be talking about climate change and our slow-moving or obstructive governing bodies. Matthew, in the New Testament, raised weather to make a moral point. He maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. And the U.S. poet James Russell Lowell connected weather to human emotion. Who knows whither the clouds have fled? In the unscarred heaven, they leave no wake, and the eyes forget the tears they have shed. The heart forgets its sorrow and ache. Here's Claudia Rankine reading her poem, Weather. Listen for the wordplay, the dual and triple meanings of umbrella, of 6 feet, of just us, of blues, and of a call.
Weather. On a scrap of paper in the archive is written, I have forgotten my umbrella. Turns out, in a pandemic, everyone, not just the philosopher, is without. We scramble in the drought of information, held back by inside traders, drop by drop. Face covering? No. Yes. Social distancing? 6 feet. Under for underlying conditions. Black. Just us and the blues kneeling on a neck with the full weight of a man in blue. 8 minutes and 46 seconds. In extremis. I can't breathe. Gives way to asphyxiation, to giving up this world. And then Mama called to a call to protest, fire, glass, say their names, say their names. White silence equals violence. The violence of again, a militarized police force, tear gassing, bullets ricochet, and civil unrest, taking it, burning it down, whatever. Contracts keep us social, compel us now to disorder the disorder. Peace, we're out to repair the future. There's an umbrella by the door, not for yesterday, but for the weather that's here. I say weather, but I mean a form of governing that deals out death and names it living. I say weather, but I mean a November that won't be held off. This time, nothing, no one forgotten. We are here for the storm that's storming, because what's taken matters.
White silence equals violence. There's no neutrality in this struggle. Staying quiet, holding back, reinforces the status quo, enables the continuing brutality, repression, disorder. Our aim is to disorder the disorder, to repair the future. We are entering a November that won't be held off. That's been Claudia Rankin bringing us the weather. I'd like to thank Old Moles, Bill Resnick, and Patricia Kohlberg for their roles in today's program, and Stephen Zunas, Alejandra Moreno, and Luisa Herrera for bringing us their wisdom and insights. Remember about the family-friendly gathering in March, this Wednesday, the day after the election, 3 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Southeast Portland. Let's hope it's a celebration and a decision to continue the struggle toward a better society. Alternatively, it will be a protest and an announcement that will continue in the streets till all votes are fairly counted. In that case, too, it will be a pledge that will continue the struggle on all the issues that face us toward a better society. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay safe and stay active.